Good evening, everybody. If you don't have one of those little books, Simple Theology, that Jason mentioned, and you would like one, please see Ian. He's up here in the front, my right. And please see him. He'll be happy to help you. So good afternoon. My name is Rob. I'm one of the pastors here at Vine and Branch. Everything you do will disappear. Your labor, your wealth, your knowledge, your vacations, your wisdom, your family line, your honor, your reputation, all of it before you will disappear. This is your 2026 pep talk. Everything you do is temporary. It's fleeting. It's a vapor. Isn't that an interesting start? That's how the author of Ecclesiastes starts his book. Mentions his name, and then he jumps right in. He bursts onto the scene. Vanity, vanity. It's all vanity. It's all disappearing. It's all going away. And then through the book, people want to answer, yeah, but what about, nope, vanity. Yeah, but I got this good thing. Nope, it's all vanity. It's a vapor. It's meaningless. It's disappearing. It's going away. This is how he starts. Why does he do that? What does he want us to know? Why would we start 2026 with this kind of a sermon? So those are some questions that I really want to get after in this opening of Ecclesiastes. We're going to spend a couple weeks here. We're going to just kind of give you a teaser, and then we're going to do two sermons in Ecclesiastes. That's going to set the tone for our year, and then also we're going to pick up with our last sermon of the year, also closing out the book of Ecclesiastes. So as we jump in, and then we got a lot of stuff going on in between there. But as we jump in, let me pray. Father, thank you for the opportunity to be in your word, for the opportunity me to teach it, but for all of us to receive it, and we do want to receive it well. We do, as Jason led us and the worship team, we have one hope, and it's in you, Christ your Son. And so we want to receive that truth in the ways that you bring us to us tonight. We want to be open to hearing your word. And then, like the Apostle James encourages us, not walking away as one who looks in a mirror and then walks away and does nothing. But we want to hear and conform. We want to hear and bend. We want to joyfully submit ourselves to the truth that you so generously give us. So help us on our way. That tonight. Amen. So our focus passage is going to be chapter 1, verses 12 through 14. But to fully appreciate these verses, I do want to kind of give us a little bit of a context. I don't have a ton of time to jump into the entire depth of the book. Probably, I know I say this a lot, but Ecclesiastes is probably one of my favorite books in the Bible. I really enjoy it. It's been very helpful personally to me. But we got to step back and consider the context that's provided in the first 11 verses of the chapter in order for 12 through 14 to make sense. So the author, tradition identifies as Solomon. There's some discussions about that, and maybe it was the beginning of his life or the end, or there's this third guy. We really don't know, but typically, most people land on the fact that it was Solomon. He identifies himself as a king of Israel, so we know that that is true. I believe it was Solomon, but again, I'm not going to die on that hill. But he introduces himself as teacher. The Hebrew word there is Kohelet, and what that actually means is one who assembles people to impart wisdom. So he's not just talking to himself, He's being intentional. I want to gather a group of people. I want to gather a group of God's people, and I need to tell them something. And that's how he identifies himself. And so some translations use the title preacher or teacher. And here we're going to, I think the ESV uses preacher, and I'll kind of bounce back and forth between preacher and teacher. It's how he identifies himself. But again, he opens the book. He bursts out with this bold, shocking pronouncement, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And we got to understand, this isn't pessimism. He's not just making a statement. It's actually a declaration that's designed to get our attention, which it does, right? It's supposed to drive home a point right out of the gate before he says anything else. And so that's the way he introduces the book. And then through verses 4 through 9, the teacher further develops this point by surveying four cycles of nature. You could almost say he calls on east, north, south, and west. And so he uses these analogies. If you look in the chapter, in 4, he starts with, verse 5, the sun rises, the sun goes down. Verse 6, the wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and round the wind goes. Verse 7, all the streams run to the sea. Verse 8, all things are full of weariness. But he uses all these elements in the world to show that there's cycles of nature. The sun rises, it sets. The wind blows, it returns. It comes back. It loops around. Rivers flow into the sea, but it never fills. It evaporates. It starts back over. And he concludes that everything under the sun is fleeting and repetitive. It's ultimately meaningless. And he's going to leave us there. It's hard for me to leave you there, right? But he's going to leave us there until the end of the book. That's really intentional. We want to solve this problem very quickly in contemporary America. We don't like to be unsettled like this. Well, wait a minute. Not everything's meaningless. Some of you are already doing that. And I didn't write this book. I'm just the messenger. But this is how the book starts. We don't like that. But we need to feel the weight of it. That's what we're supposed to do. We need to feel the weight of life without God. And hear me, church. This isn't like, you know, this isn't Hobby Lobby faith. Or, you know, bless this house. Oh, you know, I'm blessed. You know, this acknowledgement of God, but not actual submission to him. It's not what this guy is looking for. By the way, this little kind of, these nods to the Lord. When real trouble hits you, when the very things you're holding that you thought were ultimately important in life, and they seem to be vanishing, you know, the Hobby Lobby faith is not going to hold you together. It won't. It hasn't me, has it you? And so this author, the teacher, wants to push faith deeper into our being. And the way he does that is by untethering us from the rest of the world. Everything you do is meaningless. It's a vapor. He laments through these verses here in the middle, in verses 4 through 9. Generations come and go, but the earth remains. And there's nothing new under the sun. You're not going to come up with anything special that's going to make you any more special than anybody else. It's already been said. It's already been done. And people are going to have the same conversation after you. It's a vapor. If the book of Ecclesiastes was set to music, it would be a blues album. It's truth-telling, and it captures the hard realities of life under the sun. The teacher opens the book this way because he's wanting to make a stark reminder that human endeavors divorced from the Lord amount to nothing, but just a chasing of shadows. So that's kind of the context for these verses 12 through 14. Let me read those. We're going to unpack those a bit. He says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. So vanity is the word that the ESV uses, this translation that we typically use. Some translations use meaningless or futility, but the word actually means breath or vapor. It intends to describe stuff that is temporary or fleeting. It's been cold here recently. When we breathe on a winter day, the colder it gets, the more you see. But you breathe out that breath and it just goes and then it just disappears. That's what he's saying. You see it in a few seconds, for a few seconds, and then it's gone. The psalmist said the same thing, by the way, if you caught that while we were opening. So vanity means a breath or a vapor, but it also can mean an enigma or a paradox, an anomaly, a puzzle. You think A plus B equals C, but life doesn't always work that way. It's hard to pin down. It's not that simple. It's a puzzle. And so he's saying this life on earth is disappearing, and it's also puzzling. It's confounding. You think you're saving money for some future thing, and then you got to spend it on something else. It disappears. I'm hoping to go with Christian and Hope on their Guatemala trip in the spring. I want to make a deposit. I had $100 in my pocket for them last week, and they weren't here. Well, that $100 is no longer in my pocket. It disappears. It goes away. You think justice should be served, but it doesn't happen. You think you're about ahead, to get ahead, to move forward. You're thinking you're on the edge of relief. You're going to make enough. You're going to be respected. But it goes away. You can't grasp a hold of it. It's never finished. So again, this vanity means vapor or fleeting or fragile, full of paradoxes. Life doesn't work the way we expect. In the context, and even in this sermon, this may sound like blunt or harsh. This is a really difficult way to start a letter. But the teacher of Ecclesiastes insists that this kind of honesty is not cruel. It's actually merciful. That's why he's trying to drive it deep. If I could personalize what he's saying, it's this, I want your faith to outlast the things that you're striving for. And he knows until we face that reality, we will keep building our lives on things that were never meant to hold the weight that we place on them. Remember last week, we said that Proverbs observes reliable patterns of God's world. But the Proverbs don't offer ironclad guarantees. And so Proverbs says this: lazy hands make for poverty, but diligent hands bring wealth. Well, that's mostly true, right? It's not a promise, but it's mostly true in that it happens often, more often than not. If you work hard and you're diligent, it brings wealth. That's Proverbs 10:4. presenting a general principle: work hard, prosper. Wisdom works, laziness fails. But Ecclesiastes is like the annoying brother who wants to come in and mess with all that. It flips the script. Often places, he says the exact opposite. And if it is Solomon, he also wrote both books. So he's being an antithesis to himself. He's given you the other side. And I really believe the reason he's given us the other side is to deepen our faith. He wants us to know that striving and working hard and being diligent, that's great. But sometimes that doesn't work, and God covers all of it. He's increasing our faith. He's deepening it. So he brings exceptions or anomalies. He jacks around with stuff. So he says this, chapter 2, verse 18 of Ecclesiastes. I hated all the toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. Who knows whether he will be a wise or a fool? See, he's messing with the proverb. So here the teacher notes that diligent effort doesn't always guarantee success. Sometimes it doesn't work that way. Wealth and labor and accomplishment may be left to someone who's unworthy to handle them. And all your hard work goes to nothing. Life under the sun doesn't always follow the norms of Proverbs. And this exposes the limits of human wisdom and effort, right? You can do all you can, and at the end of the day, in love and sovereignty, God writes the script. I guarantee you this, there are people in South America and Africa that work harder than any of us have even thought of working in our lives, and they barely exist. It's not because they're not righteous, and it's not because God hates them. So again, from the very first sentences of the book, the teacher screams, your pursuit for truth under the sun is a vapor. But he's not a fatalist. Again, he's seeking to drive the reality of the futility of life into every corner of our being, until we feel the weight of our limited control. And this, by the way, is life under the sun. S-U-N. The question that the teacher forces us to face is not, is life worth living, right? Because some of us at this point wonder, well, then what good is it? What, you know, is life even worth living? That's not what he's pushing us towards. What he's pushing us towards is asking this question: how should we live knowing that life is brief and God is eternal? You see that? He's desperately trying to get us to anchor our meaning, our value, not in this life, but in not under the sun, but it's something beyond the sun. And he's doing that because of our propensity to chase illusions as people. This is a guy who can truly say he has been there and done that. And God set him up to have these experiments and to live these realities so that he could give us wisdom, so that he could provide us with wisdom and truth, and that God could capture it and hand it down for us. That word vanity, that means vapor or smoke or enigma, paradox, it appears 38 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. The phrase under the sun also appears 29 times. Repetition in Scripture is a teacher. We talked about this morning in men's study. And so if we bring these two thematic repetitions that happen consistently throughout the book, what we see is that God is wanting us to press, He's wanting to press something deeply into us. And what is that? God, through this wise teacher, wants us to understand that life under the sun, life lived as if this world is ultimate, it's a vapor. The teacher also turns his attention to wisdom and work throughout the rest of the book. Achievement, reading of books, knowledge, legacy. He conducts a full investigation of life, he says. I've turned over every rock. I've looked under every bush. So in verse 14, he says, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, I got to tell you something. This illusion that he wants us to get us to stop chasing is that meaning can be secured through our control or our own efforts, or that confidence comes through what I do. I don't know if that hits you like it hits me. Maybe it's I'm a guy who's always looked for confidence. I thought I wanted to write a book on it, but it always seems so elusive. Some of us really struggle with that. We think that meaning can be secured through our efforts and our experiences. And if I could just do more, and if I could just have had this experience or done this thing or accomplished that or climbed this mountain or swam that river or read this many books or could speak at this conference or do this or that, then... And the author of Ecclesiastes says, it's vapor. You're never going to be able to grasp a hold of that, Rob. If I work hard enough, if I plan carefully enough, if I save frugally enough, if I achieve high enough, vapor. Again, we can't afford to get Ecclesiastes wrong here in what the teacher is trying to tell us. He's not about fatalism. He's not about just dry up and do nothing. It's not anti-work. He's anti-illusion. I don't want you to be stuck thinking things are going to give to you something that they cannot promise. But you keep chasing after them and grasping your own breath as if it's going to produce something tangible. And it's not. Life, the teacher says, cannot be mastered. Does that bother you? You can't extract permanence from a world that God has designed to remind you that you're limited. That you're a created being who is dependent upon somebody. Life is brief. Don't skip a page. Life is brief, and what you do is limited. And denying that truth doesn't protect us, it exhausts us. Always pursuing, never catching. So when the teacher says all is vanity, It's a diagnosis of human limitation. It's pointing us to something that has to be beyond the sun, beyond what we can see, beyond what exists here to our senses, to God, the source, to the one who alone can breathe meaning into anything, to provide any lasting meaning. We must be connected to something beyond the sun. We must be connected to the one who made us. And only when we live in the Lord, this book strongly looks forward to Christ. Only when we live in the Lord can any meaning be derived at all. And even then, He must breathe that meaning into us. We can't capture it. So here's some realities. If this is true, here's some realities we must accept. We are creatures. We are not God. The preacher goes further and he says that this relentless searching or striving for meaning, he says, I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man. Notice the intensity that he says of his looking. I seek and I search out. The Hebrew actually here means to imply a diligent, exhaustive investigation, like a detective who has combed every single clue. This is the Sherlock Holmes of world investigation. And he's applying wisdom, God-given insight, to all that is done under heaven. This is another way of saying under the sun. Again, a reoccurring theme in this book. But here's the twist. This endless quest for meaning and understanding under the sun that we think is going to liberate us, it actually enslaves us. It's burdensome. And so the preacher says that it's a grievous evil that God has given to the sons of man to be afflicted with. Verse 13. What does he mean by that? Well, this word unhappy business or grievous evil carries the weight of something very heavy and afflictive. It's a strenuous, soul-wearying labor. And yet God has assigned, sovereignly assigned, this burden to men. But it's not a curse. It's a gracious discipline. It helps us stay occupied with our own limits. We realize I can't do it. I can't capture it. I can't obtain it. And how many times have you heard this? You've just won the World Series. How does that feel? And 2 weeks later, I thought that was going to do something for me that it hasn't. I just was listening to a podcast, and they asked a professional ball player, how does it feel to have just won the greatest game ever played? He said, well, if it's the greatest game ever played, we wouldn't be playing it again next year. It's a vapor. But this work that the Lord has given to the sons of man humbles us. It drives us to Him. It's spiritual weight training, and the resistance is purposeful. He wants us to see our need for Him. All this wording may seem a little bit harsh, but it matters. It's not a flaw in the system. It's not an oh shoot on God's part. He actually assigns the limits himself. God has given you limits, and you're not going to be able to break past them regardless of what you do. Time keeps moving. Death remains. You're defeated under the sun. Injustice is not always resolved. Chance corrupts even the best of plans. And so the teacher of Ecclesiastes refuses sentimental faith. He refuses to minimize faith to platitudes. He doesn't rush past suffering or flatten life into Hobby Lobby little sayings. Instead, he forces us to confront this humbling truth. You are not sovereign. You are not the Lord. And he wants us to face it. And when we face it, church, hear me, this is so helpful. We can see that our limits are not necessarily failures or God's unfairness. You with me? Some of you want some things and you don't have them. And it's not because you're not good enough or because God hates you. It's the lot that he has given to you. Some of you want to be married and you're not. And it's not because you're broken or there's something wrong with you or you're not quite there yet. And once you get married, you can fit in with the rest of us. You hear me? Sometimes this is the lot that God gives us. Some of you are suffering with ongoing chronic illnesses that are not going to go away. It's not because you don't have enough faith. It's not because you're broken or because God hates you. He assigns our limits. These God-designed boundaries are meant to reorder our loves. And when we forget that we are creatures, we demand of life what it never was meant to give. And so, this is why this book, this wonderful, amazing book, is not cynical, it's clarifying. It's helpful. God strips away our false hopes so that true faith can survive. If I were to put this in a brief saying, I would say it this way. Life is brief. God is eternal. I'm limited. And I'm all right with that. That's what the author of Ecclesiastes wants us to get. Life is brief. God is eternal. I am limited. And it's okay. He's still God. We might still be asking, man, does life even matter? Does anything I do matter? Is there meaning or value into anything? Oh, man. Probably 2027, we're going to take a real deep dive through this entire book. Okay, there's so much richness and depth. But at this point, it's important at least to jump forward to see another theme that's woven throughout the book that answers this question of meaning. It's not repeated as many times, and actually its silence and where it's repeated is more important than its numbers. And its precise location of where it's repeated is very important. And the topic is essential to to understanding, is there meaning in what I do? Is there value in anything? And this is the thing, this is the theme that's repeated strategically in the book. God's judgment. The teacher observes that life under the sun is unjust. A lot of times, not always, but often. The righteous suffer. He goes through the fact that religious leaders fail. He talks about coming right out of the sanctuary where you meet with God and standing on the steps, and he's watching brothers wrong one another as they come out of church. God's people hurt each other. The wicked prosper. But hear me, because of God's judgment, that is not the final word on every matter under the sun. God's judgment is the final answer to everything under the sun. It brings meaning and purpose to everything. You see that? Oftentimes we hear God's judgment and we want to cower and cringe. But if we're hooked into Him, if we believe in Him, we await His judgment. It's actually going to set us free. So in verse 3, verse 17, the teacher tells us plainly, God will judge both the righteous and the wicked. In chapter 11, verse 9, for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Chapter 12, verse 14, and this is how he ends the book, God will bring every work into judgment, including every hidden thing. So this judgment of God appears only a few times explicitly, but it carries enormous weight. It tells us that life is not meaningless. Everything is accountable to God. That and that gives everything meaning. You see it? God's judgment anchors the book. And again, I think some of us are still trying to get over seeing judgment as a bad thing. But here we begin to see it as a good thing. God's righteousness and His justice anchor the book. God is beyond the sun. Without Him and His justice, everything truly is a vapor. But because God is eternal and just, then everything we do matters. Father, I'm trying, and I'm not even sure I get all of it. I know I don't. But run this truth deep into our hearts, this flip of a switch, this everything seems meaningless under the sun until we are found in you. And because of your eternality and you're not cyclical, you march on forward forever from one end of eternity to the next. And because you're judge and justifier, and because everything, even hidden things, will come up before you, then everything we do matters. Help us, Lord, to grasp that in a way that affects the way we live daily. Amen. Everything we do matters. Not because we earn our worth, but because we acknowledge the God who's above the sun. We live in light of God's eternality, His character, His values. We do not just live merely with what works under the sun. Our system, it's bigger. And that's exactly what the author wants us to see. He wants to push that reality until we say, I need something else. I need something more than what exists here in the things under the sun that I can see. I have to have something else. He introduces us to Him. And because of that, we're given wisdom. And the author has said that. He's gone from far ends of the earth to turn over every stone so we don't have to. And when we acknowledge what he acknowledges, we gain the wisdom that he has gained. The teacher begins with vapor and vanity, but he is looking forward to a conclusion. He knows where he wants to take us through 12 chapters. So the book doesn't end in despair, it ends in clarity. And here's what he says in chapter 12, verse 13. The end of the matter has been heard. I've seen all of it. Let me boil it all down for you. You want to find meaning? You want to know what security looks like? Do you want to be purposeful? Do you want to have confidence? The end of the matter has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. And in this, everything you do matters. For God will bring every deed into judgment. He sees it. It's good. So to fear God is to live with reverence, to recognize who is eternal, he is, and who is not. We're not. It's to stop placing ultimate expectations on temporary things, especially those things that are rooted in ourselves. And this call to fear the Lord, Ecclesiastes repeatedly offers this up, and it pairs fearing the Lord with something that's surprisingly tender. Enjoyment. Here's his answer. We're going to get into this next week. So enjoy your food. Enjoy your work. Enjoy your hardships. Enjoy your relationships. Fear the Lord. He ties those things together. Fear God. Keep his commandments. Enjoy what he's given you, because he gives perfect gifts. So enjoy these things, not as gods, not as guarantees, not as earnings, but as gifts. This is your lot. Here's the key. Total trust, hear this please, total trust in God frees me to enjoy life as it comes to me. Total trust in the Lord frees me up to enjoy life as it comes to me. Not as I think it ought to be, not as I think I need to be this person or have these qualifications, not as I try to make it to be, But as it is, the lot that God has given to me. Total trust in God frees me to enjoy life as he gives it to me. That's helpful to me. I hope that's doing something to you, that truth. The Spirit's working that in you. When I trust God completely, I no longer need to perform for me. But I can receive life moment by moment without resentment, without anxiety, or without attempting to secure my meaning in it. Man, for somebody who strives a lot, this is good news. It really is. When I don't have to wring my meaning out of life, but I can only receive it as a gift from the one who is above the sun, it's a gift. So this is where Ecclesiastes, the truth that the teacher offers, reshapes our life. When God is eternal and I am not, wisdom produces. Write this down if it's not in your notes. I can't remember. Here's what wisdom produces: contentment, gratitude, and self-control. When I don't have to wring my meaning out of life, when I don't have to go earn it or pursue it, when it's given to me, when I realize that the things that I have to do on my own are actually vapors and they disappear, and when I lock in to the one who is above the sun, that I get wisdom, that wisdom produces in me a contentment. I don't need more to be whole. If I am in Christ, that's it. Gratitude. Everything I have is received and not earned. I'm content with who and what God has made me and what He gives me, and I'm grateful. And then I'm also self-controlled. Think about that. You with me? If you're not following, we need to talk after, or you need to keep pondering that. This is really important. This is so good. I don't need to consume or to control what cannot save me. Contentment and gratitude ends addictions. Because this thing under the sun cannot give me what I think it is promising me. I don't need to consume that. I don't need to partake in that. I'm going to do this because these things cannot save me. And those three things, contentment, gratitude, and self-control, are the taproots for confidence. Confidence is not the root, it's a byproduct. Confidence is a byproduct of contentment, gratitude, and self-control. But this confidence is not in what I've done. It's not in what I've built. It's not in what I've achieved. Our confidence rests in God's presence, God's work, and God's provision. You see it? See, and when my confidence is anchored in Him, I no longer am frenetic under the sun. Last week sometime I was reading in Proverbs, and I came across this verse: the Lord will be your confidence. And I thought, I want that. And the Lord said, that's good, because you're getting ready to study, and I'm about to help you with that. Because in my mind, I want confidence is the root, because confidence will allow me to do these other things. It's not the root. It's a byproduct of contentment and gratitude and self-control. Think about this for a minute. Somebody comes up to you and starts talking to you, and even slandering you, maybe even telling you all the things that you're not, and maybe a bunch of them are true. But if you're content and grateful and self-controlled, what's that going to do to you? That's confidence. But it's not in me, or what I've done, or what I've built, or what I've accomplished. Our confidence rests in I know the one above the sun. I know what He's done for me, and He has drawn close to me, and He's provided everything I need. The Lord will be your confidence. So we're going to wrap up. Ecclesiastes does not tell us that life is meaningless. It tells us that it is too small to bear the weight of being ultimate. Our life, as important as it is to us right now, is not ultimate. So as we look forward to this year, we're going to study lots of passages. We're going to wrestle with important topics. I'm actually really excited about it. So there's there's a teaching schedule on the back. It's also on our line on our calendar. But today, this really sets the tone because everything under the sun is temporary and our confidence is anchored not in what we do, hear me, not in what we learn, not in the wisdom we gain, but in God's provision and His presence. Oh, this is important. If I can say this, for a church that we kind of are proud of our Bible knowledge, if I can say that out loud, we are. And we need to be really careful about that. Because our Bible knowledge doesn't save us. Christ does. Lord, keep us humble. Help us be patient. Our knowledge is important. It is not ultimate. It's not my idea. That's the Lord's. Our confidence is anchored not in what we do, not in what we learn, or the wisdom we gain, but in God's presence and provision. But may this shape how we approach our learning, how we approach our work, and our daily efforts. May we pursue growth in wisdom and serve faithfully, but not as it depends upon us to accomplish the work that only Christ Himself can do, but as a joyful response to the God who is eternal, to the God who is over everything under the sun. Trusting Him with the outcomes that we can't control, so that in everything we may live with confidence and gratitude and self-control and contentment. Father, I have been a lost man for so long. And I am just so thankful for Your word. I was excited about it in my study. Even as the words come out of my mouth and I'm hearing them for my own heart, I'm more excited about Your word now, together with my church family. Thank You for this great group of people that I know resonates with that. We recognize our lostness. Help us to stay humble. That it's Your truth. That it's all about You. That You alone breathe meaning into everything. Thank You for rescuing us with Your wisdom, even as it comes out of Your word to us. And we gather here today. Some of us came just thinking we were coming to a gathering with a bunch of other Christians, but we genuinely came to church where You meet, Your word is spoken, and we get to receive it and grow and change. It's a miracle. It's a real gift. So help us to live wisely with humility instead of illusion, with trust instead of control. Help us to live with gratitude and contentment and self-control, and that You would be our confidence. Life is brief, Father. You are eternal. Help us to live accordingly. Amen.